trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. Hey, glad you could join us today. Our sponsors include MonticelloCollege.org, Pure-Light.com, some of the most amazing light bulbs you will ever see in your life. Yes, they do the work of a $1,000 air purifier. Go to their website and check them out. There's a link in the show notes. And also HSLAmmo.com. Just want to give a quick shout out and props to my friend Spencer Worthington. What a great guy he is. What a great American. And providing something that not only creates value for those who enjoy the shooting sports and want to convert their money into skill, but also a guy who's creating great opportunity right there in his own community. So where to begin for this hour of the show? I think I want to take you back. Come with me, if you will, young feller, and let's sit down and talk about when the best advice of the day was "Go west, young man." Was it Horace Greeley who said that, encouraging people, you know, head out to California? That's the place you ought to be. Sorry, I think I just lapsed into the Beverly Hillbillies theme. Why are people fleeing California though today? I mean, look, I remember the first time I visited California. I think I was probably 18 years old. And, you know, had never been there before. I had friends who had grown up in California, but I had mostly just been around Utah and Idaho and hadn't really been very many other places. I think my only claim to fame, well, I went to Wyoming once, which, by the way, not knocking Wyoming. I'm just saying that was pretty much the extent of my travels. Utah, Idaho, Wyoming. Whew. Yes, sir. I got around. But I had heard of California as this incredible mystical place. And of course, you know, I'd watched television and had seen, you know, especially Southern California portrayed as kind of like, hey, you know, it don't get much better than us. And when I went there for the first time myself, I was blown away at just how nice, how new, how upbeat everything seemed. There was clearly action taking place there. And I immediately understood there's a lot of people here, but I get why. You know, that beautiful climate, so, you know, the opportunities. There's no doubt that it brought people running. So why are they fleeing in ever greater numbers today? That's a question that James R. Harrigan takes on. In fact, he says, go east, young man. Here's what he says. He says, go west, young man, go west and grow up with the country. You know, it's been attributed to Horace Greeley by so many for so long that it's almost as if he actually said the words, but he didn't, and said as much to anyone who would listen. But no matter. By the time he allegedly offered that advice in 1865, people had been streaming into California for the better part of 16 years. The 49ers started a pattern of migration that would last just over 170 years. And here's an interesting little statistic. Every year, come hell or high water, California saw its population increase until 2020. Now, this is where James R. Harrigan excels. He crunches numbers and then he puts them with words and he makes a pretty descriptive and accurate depiction of what reality is. He says, until 2020, by the end of that year, California's population had dropped by 182,000 people. Now, that may seem like a drop in the bucket when you look at the Golden State's 39.51 million population, but it came on the heels of the loss of a House seat after the 2020 census reapportionment and looks for all the world to be a portent of things to come. Businesses and high-profile entrepreneurs have been heading east for a few years now, and that trend is growing. For every Elon Musk, Joe Rogan, and Gene Simmons who leave, there are scores of lower-profile people and companies leaving right along with them. And his point is, it's starting to add up. What are the reasons for this exodus? Well, James R. Harrigan says everybody seems to be singing the same song. It's the burdensome regulatory regime and the extraordinarily high cost of living that has people looking for greener pastures. And he says, no matter how obvious this is to any impartial observer, California politicians just can't seem to make any peace with it. It starts at the top with feckless Governor Gavin Newsom facing a much-deserved recall. He has decided that what the people of the state really need are bigger recovery checks. He's literally trying to buy his way out of a recall. Big surprise. But frankly, there has been something rotten in Sacramento for quite some time, and it was always a matter of when, not if, all of the dominoes would start falling. The answer, it seems, is right about now. And he says, if this comes as any surprise to anyone, consider how long California has been a single-party regime. Democrats have held both houses of the state legislature for 22 years. They've held the governorship for 11. Their idea of setting things right? Hiring Clinton refugee D.D. Myers, who Governor Newsom recently announced will serve as senior advisor to the governor and director of the governor's Office of Business and Economic Development, GoBiz, which is a cabinet-level position. GoBiz, D.D. Myers. You read that right. Governor Newsom says California is the world's fifth largest economy and gateway to the rest of the world. While the COVID-19 pandemic has greatly impacted our economy, California will bounce back thanks to our incredible assets and our spirit of innovation. An economic recovery that lifts all Californians will require us to work together. With more than three decades of experience in both the public and private sectors in California and nationally, DD brings an ability to work across sectors, ensuring that our recovery is built upon common ground and common solutions. End quote. Now, James R. Harrigan points out, the exodus from California, it's still a trickle, and there are more companies staying than leaving at this point, so there is some reason to hold out hope. But he says, for every company committed to staying in California, there are a raft of problems that require answers, and no one, not Newsom, not Myers, seems to have any. Their echo chamber is so complete that they have no understanding of Democratic Party culpability. It was, after all, decades of Democratic policies that rendered California so expensive that the people who would be willing and qualified to work in the state simply cannot afford to live there. He says there's nothing more telling than the patterns of U-Haul truck rentals. In 2020, California had the biggest net loss of any state. How bad was the outflow? Victor Venegas, of district vice president at U-Haul, had this to say. For a good part of this year, we've had far more customers than we've actually had equipment to serve those customers. Given that almost none of U-Haul's trucks are coming into the state, expect those shortages to continue. Harrigan says people will find a way to leave regardless. The disincentives of staying are simply too strong. U-Haul reports that the lion's share of those heading for greener pastures are finding their way to Nevada, Arizona, Oregon, Washington, and Colorado. The citizens of those states are a little, or more than a little, concerned that the newcomers from California will bring their disastrous politics with them, but that's for another day. What matters now is whether California will do anything at all to make it a more palatable possibility for people who would be inclined to live there. And James R. Harrigan says, if not, we'll see continued erosion of the tax base, as it's only people who pay taxes who are inclined to leave, and a smaller congressional contingent with each passing census. How bad can it get? Well, there were 170 years of growth. The opposite is a distinct possibility. And it would probably take that long for everyone who wanted one to rent a U-Haul anyway. Having just been through the rent a U-Haul and moved to a different state experience myself, it really is a pretty accurate way to determine, where are people going? Where are they voting with their feet? I know a lot of wonderful people who are, in effect, behind enemy lines in California. And I think a lot of them have strong incentives. If they wanted to move on, they could. Many of them won't, simply because they love their state. They want to make things work. But it's not easy under the regulatory burden. Had a friend from there who was explaining how she and her family were looking to do an addition on their home. And we're not talking, it's not like Hearst Castle. I mean, this is, it's just, it's a suburban family home, But she was describing part of the bureaucracy that she had to work through, the number of fees and inspectors and different government types who had to show up and give their permission to make things, okay. It was utterly staggering. I mean, like, to the point where I would have said, man, I'd probably thrown my hands in the air a long time ago and said, I can't do this. I'll just go somewhere else where there's a little bit more freedom. Yep, California's got a lot going for it. But it's in spite of what its government is doing to the state and not because of what its government is doing. That's probably a good lesson for other states as well and for people everywhere as well.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
And we are back. Thanks again for being a member of our growing audience of wrong thinkers. By the way, if you really want to stay informed, or at least be better informed, I strongly recommend the Resources for Wrong Thinkers page at my website, thebrianhydeshow.com. I like to put out daily show notes. Every episode that I publish has accompanying show notes with links to the articles, the commentators that I discuss, as well as, sometimes I'll throw in a few annotations of my own. But if you really want to get this information, you want to skip the middleman, that would be me. Go to the Resources for Wrong Thinkers page and look at some of the different news aggregator sites, some of the places where you can actually subscribe for a weekly or daily email, as the case may be, and then sit back and just let the information come to you. You can pick and choose what articles you find that are of interest, but there's some very well-informed, scholarly people who are not driven by the red versus blue mentality and don't spend the majority of their time spouting bumper sticker slogans. I mean, we live in a time of crisis. I think most reasonable people would agree. And if there is one thing that is of extreme importance as a citizen during times of crisis, it's to maintain your ability to think clearly and independently. That means you got to be willing to do a lot of your own digging and a lot of your own research and thinking about what you're learning. You can't just sit back and let somebody spoon feed it to you. That means me too. I can't give you this information. Here you go. Here's what you need to believe. That's insulting. You have personal responsibility. You have autonomy. You have a brain. You got to use it. That's how a free man or woman would go about living their life. Moving on. Gosh, has it been? Yeah, it's been like 30 years ago that Van Halen, more appropriately Van Hagar, released their song Right Now. Wow, it's actually been longer than that, now that I'm thinking about it. The video had a quote in there that said something along the lines of, "The world is run by oil companies and old men." By the way, in the last 30 years, I haven't seen a lot of evidence that would dissuade me from that notion. I think there's probably some truth there. Robert E. Wright, writing for the American Institute for Economic Research, has a terrific essay on gerontocracy and geezernomics, which in a nutshell is how aged politicians are crippling the future of those who would follow them. So I want you to think of this in terms of, this is not just let's bag on, who's in power, but let's look at what they're actually doing and what it's doing for those who will follow them along life's path. He says the U.S. government has become a gerontocracy where ancient ones like President Biden, age 78, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, age 81, and top pseudoscientist Anthony Sleek Fauci, age 80, rule with a liver-spotted iron fist, imposing on the rest of the country what is best described as geezernomics, or a system of economic policies that profits superannuated elites at the expense of most other Americans. The Bible, mothers, Plato, and common sense tell us to respect our elders, but that doesn't mean we should be ruled by them. At some point, loss of mental acuity outpaces any gains from added experience, which is why we don't just make our oldest geezer president. For the unconversant in American slang, an old geezer is a very elderly person, often one who is odd or cranky. So I'm thinking that's probably not a misapplied term here. Geezernomics, Robert Wright says, these geezernomic policies are also quite odd, the stuff of monetary and fiscal cranks who have little to no incentive to support the general welfare, whatever that is. Instead, they pursue self-interested policies with even more gusto than their younger colleagues. In addition to being notoriously vulnerable to scams and flimflams, very old people do not have much skin in the game, even wrinkled skin, because they do not have much time left. If they have children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, and so forth, as most do, they have an incentive to bequeath them as much wealth as they can, so they want to extract economic rents quickly before it's too late. Like Manker Olson's roving bandit, the ancient ones would rather raid than trade and prefer taking to making. While their younger colleagues want to preserve taxpayers for future exploitation, the superannuated want everything, and they want it now. They do not care that their policies increase the already massive national debt and money supply, or damage the English language by calling anything they want infrastructure. Racist policies, anti-racist, and political ploys, science. They don't care if their policies destroy the nuclear family, the educational system, the moral and religious values systems, the very pillars of civil society. And the expected costs of behaving badly almost vanish for the elderly. What good would it do to stick Fauci or even Andrew Cuomo, age 63, on death row for their crimes against humanity? Both will be dead in bed before they die in the chair, even if arrested today. Now, Robert E. Wright says maybe politicians care a little bit about how future generations will judge them, but they must realize they cannot hide their decades of sin forever. So the marginal reputational cost of some extra sins at the end is small. They must also know the future historical interpretations of them will wax and wane with the politics of the time or the cultural zeitgeist, just as it has for George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and so forth. He says the only certainty is that the winners write the history. So best be a winner by getting as rich as possible. Big trust funds will give their progeny plenty of time to write whitewashed biographies of them. Now, Robert E. Wright says, most importantly, of all the gerontocrats, they will not have to live long under the poor policies they create, so they can impose ineffective, short-sighted ones without personally bearing the costs. Just as our healthcare system can persist as one of the worst in the developed world on a cost-benefit basis, almost 20% of GDP for so-so results, because members of Congress created a much better system for themselves, so too can Fauci lie about every major aspect of the pandemic. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, age 74, can change her tune about huge federal deficits. And President Biden... That was an interesting Freudian slip. President Biden can turn formerly fierce military warriors into woke social justice warriors. Ashley Hunter et al. Will live on as wealthy party royalty, whether in the Democratic Party or the CCP. Mandatory retirement seems the only reasonable solution to the geezernomic policies desired by the gerontocracy. Like the Oak Ridge Boys song, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. There's also a line in a semisonic song called Closing Time. Mandatory retirement doesn't mean that you have to stop working, just that you can't work here anymore. The federal government itself imposes mandatory retirement on some of its own workers. FBI special agents and federal firefighters, for example, have to retire at age 57. That makes sense, as both jobs have significant physical components that older people have demonstrably more difficulty fulfilling. Mental acuity generally declines later and is more difficult to detect, but nonetheless certainly occurs in most people. The federal government recognizes that, so unless they are given a special exemption, foreign service employees in the State Department must depart at age 65. Most other federal employees must retire at age 70. Rules for state government employees vary. In Massachusetts, for example, only police officers, firefighters, and correction officers must retire at age 65. Judges at age 70. To be a good judge requires mental acuity that many older individuals simply can no longer consistently display. For that reason, judges in many states must retire at 70 or 75. Supreme Court of the United States justices, though, may serve for life. Now, the wisdom of that policy, however, is being questioned once again. Why stop at SCOTUS, he asks. Why should any superannuated individual be allowed to ruin the world, deliberately or not, as they exit it? He says maybe we should add a maximum age for the president of the United States, amend the Constitution so nobody over 62 can run for the office. So if he or she serves two full terms, he or she will be out of office before his or her 70th birthday. Ditto members of Congress. It's not like there's a dearth of people qualified to hold those offices after all. Now, there is precedent for mandatory retirement for policymakers and executives in federal law. Although under the Age Discrimination in Employment Act of 1967, employers in the U.S. usually cannot force employees to retire. But an exception is made for executives and policymakers. After all, it doesn't matter much if an office assistant or line worker is losing it, but if a CEO or board chair is no longer all there, well, for the for and nonprofit entities, in that case, could be suffering huge losses. So federal law recognizes they should be able to protect themselves from the depredations of entrenched cronies and straight-up geezers who may have seemed fine at the beginning of their terms, but by the end may prove to be ineffective or even disastrous. We'll come back to Robert Wright's article on gerontocracy and geezernomics just the other side of the break.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
And just like that, we are back. I've been sharing with you some thoughts from Robert E. Wright from the American Institute for Economic Research, AIER.org. Gerontocracy and geezernomics. And this may sound like you're unfairly picking on a bunch of elderly politicians, but look, it's not just because of their personalities, okay? I understand. Biden's quirky, so are many of the other people in leadership positions in the federal government. It's their policies. It's what they're doing. It's their actions. Their time is short, and yet they are leaving a terrible mess for those who follow behind them to clean up. Does that seem responsible? Does that seem like the fair thing to do? By the way, Robert Wright points out, you know, a critic may argue, well, you know, the people choose to vote for these gerontocrats. But he asks, do they really? No candidate receives more than half the votes of the entire electorate because voter participation rates are always so low. Moreover, the choice with any possible impact on the election is almost always between two major party candidates selected by an even smaller slice of the population. See, this is making the hardcore voters go, hey, you're making me uncomfortable. Picking between the geezer with the elephant and the old-timer with the donkey next to their names doesn't really solve the root incentive or superannuation problems identified here. So Robert Wright says, of course, the best solution would be to strip government officials of most of their power and restore stringent checks and balances, especially in fiscal matters, so that our national government remains one strictly limited to defense and diplomacy as the founders intended. But he says, barring that miracle, let's at least not to let the ancient ones destroy the country with huge deficits and senseless solutions to drummed up or government-induced problems related to climate, income distribution, and race relations. Most babies born today, one hopes, will live to see at least the opening of the 22nd century. Why should some self-interested geezers with one foot in the grave born before the mid-20th century be able to diminish the quality of their lives? I understand if some people would say, ooh, that seems kind of harsh. Have you looked, though, at what the members of this gerontocracy are doing? I don't think it's harsh at all. It's a little blunt, but sometimes that's a necessity. This leads me to another topic that I hope will cause, likewise, just enough discomfort to cause some introspection. That's if you feel uncomfortable here, it's not because I delight in causing people, you know, pain. I'm not a sadist. I don't like to see people, you know, suffer under, oh, why did you make me think about this? But money is one of those topics that it does. We all have some baggage when it comes to money. Some of us more than others. But when you start talking about things like, well, you know, we have competition in so many other areas of our lives, and competition, frankly, has led to drastic improvement in just about every area of our lives. If there's something good that makes your life easier, I can promise you, competition has something to do with it. Someone found a better way to do something and then capitalized on it and turned it into a way to, you know, sell you a microwave oven or sell you a smartphone or whatever that is. And you can complain, well, they're just getting rich, man, and they don't even pay that many taxes. You're missing, though, the obvious thing right in front of you. How much better is your life? You know, you can pick up a tablet or a smartphone or a laptop computer and work, you know, accomplish things from right where you are through management of information. I mean, you know, this is competition. So why is it that so few people see a positive side when it comes to a competitive market for money? Got a great article here from Josh Hendrickson. And he says, we here at Economic Forces talk a lot about competitive markets. We also highlight how worried people are about monopoly and dig into whether there's any reason to worry. But he says, what about something like dollars? To some extent, dollars are issued competitively, as in the case of deposits. However, only the Federal Reserve prints up physical currency. Yet there's little in the way of public complaints about this. And so he asks, how can we use price theory to think about a competitive money supply? And what are the macroeconomic implications of these price theoretic insights? Now, here are a couple things worth considering. He says, in theory, we don't need money. Trade doesn't require money. We could always barter. We could always trade entirely on credit. Why do we need to pass some rock or piece of paper or coin back and forth? And the answer seems to be that people are evil. Okay, maybe not evil, but certainly not always trustworthy. A system of credit works well when everyone can trust everyone else or when society can sufficiently punish those who go back on their promises. When trade is fairly anonymous or when it's hard to punish people for not delivering on their promise, though, credit just isn't feasible. And if credit isn't feasible, one could always turn to barter. However, barter isn't really a much better option. Trading goods for other goods is difficult. The transaction costs are high. Some goods aren't divisible. Sometimes people don't have anything that you want to purchase or you don't have anything they want to purchase. When barter is costly and people have a hard time committing to future actions, people need to figure out ways to exchange. One way this might be possible is to experiment with a certain type of barter. For example, one might figure out the types of goods that nearly anyone would be willing to accept, even if they just accept it in order to turn around and sell the good to someone else later on. Through this process, certain types of goods will start to emerge as a medium of exchange. The goods that emerge will tend to have certain characteristics. For example, these goods will tend to be portable, recognizable, durable, and divisible. That explains why things like precious metals emerge to fill this role. Once something like a precious metal emerges as a medium of exchange, though, there needs to be some sort of process of creating a standard unit of measurement or a unit of account. In other words, suppose that gold is the precious metal that emerges as money. How would you specify prices? You could specify them in ounces, but ounces of what? Gold, you say? Okay, but what if I give you an ounce of some kind of gold alloy? Is it really the same if 10% of the gold alloy is made up of gold as it is when 90% of the alloy is made up of gold? And the answer is of course not. The value depends on what the gold is mixed with. As a result, people are going to come up with a standardized unit of account. For example, one might define the dollar as 1/20th of an ounce of gold, where the gold is 9 out of 10 fine. Given this definition, everything can be priced in terms of this standard unit of account known as the dollar. Okay, he asks, what does this have to do with price theory? Well, he says, let's think about supply and demand. When we think about supply and demand, what we're really thinking about are relative prices. The cost of bread is how much of some other good that I have to give up to get the bread. In other words, the cost of bread might be thought of as a 2-liter bottle of Coca-Cola or a half gallon of milk. Relative prices are what matter for our decision-making. Of course, changes in dollar prices and changes in relative prices can be the same thing. If there's a drought in Florida that reduces the supply of oranges, the relative price of oranges will go up. But this typically occurs through an increase in the dollar price of oranges. But he says, think about what happens when the unit of account is defined as a particular quantity of a commodity. Given the definition of the dollar that he gave earlier, $1 equals 1/20th of an ounce of gold, 9/10 fine. By definition, this implies that the price of an ounce of gold of the specified quality is $20. The dollar price of gold is fixed by the definition of the dollar, yet gold is traded independently of its use as a medium of exchange. For instance, people buy and sell gold jewelry. Thus, supply and demand should determine the price of gold, but the dollar price of gold is fixed. How do you reconcile that? And he says, this is where an understanding that supply and demand is about relative prices becomes important. Well, it's true that a change in the supply or demand for gold will result in a price change. Supply and demand really just says the relative price of gold will change. And typically, this means that the dollar price will change, but in this example, the dollar price is fixed by the definition of $1. This means that the dollar prices of all other goods will have to change to clear the market. So considering the following, for example, suppose that there is gold discovery. Holding everything else constant, this increase in the supply of gold should cause the price of gold to decline. Since the dollar price of gold is fixed, other prices will have to rise to clear the market such that the relative price of gold declines. Furthermore, he says, note that the dollar prices of all other goods have to change such that relative prices between those goods all stay the same, since the only thing that changed was the supply of gold. Otherwise, there would be an arbitrage opportunity. If the relative prices of all other goods must stay the same, then the dollar prices of these goods must rise proportionally. Thus, gold discovery leads to a higher price level. We have generated a macroeconomic implication from our basic understanding of price theory. I know it's getting a little bit technical. I'll have a couple more thoughts to share from this when we come back, but a competitive market for money, I would welcome it, because I believe that if there was sound money, that's where people would go. And he talks about what sound money might look like. We'll touch on that when we come back.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
All right, welcome back to the show. So I've been sharing with you this article from Josh Hendrickson, and it's about competitive markets for money. And he gets into some pretty detailed, and you know, this is kind of a technical explanation. It's a great article to read. I'll have it linked in the show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. But let's cut to the chase here for a moment. And he says, let's think about a world of competitive paper money. If I'm an entrepreneur and I want to issue my own paper money, how do I get it into circulation? He says, one way to do this would be to simply print up some of these pieces of paper and try to buy things with them. But the success of this type of scheme is dependent on people being willing to accept these pieces of paper as payment. Conceivably, a network effect is necessary to get those pieces of paper circulating. People will be willing to accept my pieces of paper as payment if they expect that other people will also accept them as payment. But this is difficult. One reason why this is difficult is due to the last period problem. Suppose there is some date in the future where people are no longer willing to accept these pieces of paper. In that period, the pieces of paper are worthless. However, that also means that they are worthless in the prior period, and that means that they are also worthless in the period before that. Through backward induction, this means the pieces of paper are worthless today. Now, this problem doesn't exist with something like gold. If at some point nobody's willing to accept the gold coins, well, the gold can just be melted down and sold or consumed. And it does have, you know, industrial uses. But he says, by the same logic, one way to solve this last period problem is to promise to buy those pieces of paper back for some given quantity of a commodity. For example, a currency issuing firm might offer to give anyone holding this currency a particular quantity of gold per unit of currency. If, for example, they promise to give these currency holders 1 ounce of gold in exchange for 20 units of their currency, which they call dollars, well, he says that's identical to the gold example I discussed earlier. The promise to buy back the currency at a future date alleviates the last period problem and therefore makes it much more likely the currency will circulate. But he asks, doesn't this create a problem? Shouldn't we fear inflation from the issuance of this competitive money? For example, we know from price theory that firms maximize their profits when marginal revenue is equal to marginal cost. Now, the marginal cost of producing paper money is approximately zero, since it costs the same amount to print a $1 bill as it does to print a $1 million bill. If this is the case, doesn't this mean that these competitive note issuers will print too much paper money and will just end up with inflation? Well, he says the answer is no. And here's why. To keep things simple, suppose that all paper money is denominated in dollars and the dollar is defined as a particular quantity of gold. In that case, the price level is determined by the supply and demand for gold, just as it was in the case in which the dollar was some abstract definition for a quantity of gold. The paper currency itself is just a derivative contract. In particular, the way that he's defined them, he says these paper dollars are just perpetual American-style call options on gold. As long as the issuers of those dollars are committed to redeeming these pieces of paper for gold, as promised, the pieces of paper are as good as gold. Just as the issuance of an options contract for a stock doesn't affect the price of the stock, the issuance of convertible paper money does not affect the value of gold and therefore does not affect the price level. So if banks issue too many pieces of paper, they'll simply be redeemed for gold. Interesting. Now, he talks about, with the emergence of cryptocurrencies, there is the possibility of competition in currency once again. And, of course, these cryptocurrencies would have to be used as media of exchange rather than as speculative assets. One thing to note about cryptocurrencies is that, unlike convertible paper money, they don't solve the late period problem. If there's some future period in which nobody wants to accept Bitcoin, then these Bitcoins will have no value. They cannot be redeemed for anything. This world is sort of like a world without competing fiat monies. Many argued this sort of world wouldn't be possible. However, he says Ben Klein argued such a world can exist and outlined how a competitive fiat system would operate. But that's another topic for another day. If you want to delve into some competitive money thinking, this is a great article to get you started. Okay, going to end on a positive note here. If you're looking for something to lift your spirits, Daniel Mitchell may have just what you're looking for. Because he reminds us in a recent column that by historical standards, Americans today are fantastically wealthy. What, you don't feel that way? Okay, I want you to hear what he has to say. He says, I've spent decades, several decades, trying to convince people that we should have free markets and small government in order to increase national prosperity. In fact, he says, I've even pointed out how very small increases in annual growth can lead to big improvements in living standards over just a couple of decades. But some folks on the left, he says, are not very receptive to this argument. They genuinely, but incorrectly, seem to think that the economy is a fixed pie, which also explains, at least in part, why they're so focused on redistribution. So let's share some hard data in hopes of getting them to understand that more prosperity is possible. And he starts with a chart of inflation-adjusted per capita economic output in the United States, which comes from Oxford University's Our World in Data. Now, you'll have to go to the article to see the charts for yourself, but the obvious takeaway from this data is that Americans are much richer today than they were after World War II. Adjusted for inflation, we're now about four times richer than our grandparents. Now, some of our friends on the left might be thinking, well, those numbers are distorted. That average output has only increased because the rich have gotten so much richer. And it's true that the rich have gotten richer. But it's also true that the rest of us have become richer as well. That's why he shared data earlier this year showing that median living standards, rather than mean or average living standards, demonstrate this. Folks on the left may suspect that post-1950 data is an anomaly. In other words, maybe he's just cherry-picking the data. That's a common practice in the world of policy. So he says, I don't blame people for being suspicious. So he says, take a look at this chart, which I also shared earlier this year. And it's a chart that shows that the increase in living standards has been even more dramatic if you look at the changes since 1820. And by the way, none of these observations are new. Back in 1997, Michael Cox and Richard Ulm wrote a must-read article for the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank's annual report. And some of their findings included, what really matters isn't what something costs in money, it's what it costs in time. Making money takes time, so when we shop, we're really spending time. The real cost of living isn't measured in dollars and cents, but in the hours and minutes we must work to live. So a pair of stockings cost just 25 cents a century ago, and that sounds wonderful until you learn that the workers of those of that era only earned about 14.8 cents an hour. So paying for the stockings took an hour, 41 minutes of work. Today, a better pair requires only about 18 minutes of work. In calculating our cost of living, a good place to start is the basics: food, shelter, and clothing. In terms of time on the job, the cost of a half gallon of milk fell from 39 minutes in 1919 to just 16 minutes in 1950, 10 minutes in 1975, and 7 minutes in 1997. A pound of ground beef steadily declined from 30 minutes worth of work in 1919 to 23 minutes in 1950, 11 minutes in 1975, and only 6 minutes in 1997. Paying for a dozen oranges required an hour, 8 minutes of work in 1919. Now it takes less than 10 minutes. That's half what it did in 1950. Kind of an interesting way to illustrate this. And by the way, there's another couple of visuals from the article showing like washing machines and cook stoves and so forth. Products have become more and more affordable over time. He says, Professor Don Boudreau put these numbers in context a few years ago in a column he wrote for the Foundation for Economic Education. Some of what he wrote is, what is the minimum amount of money that you would demand in exchange for your going back to live, even as John Rockefeller lived in 1916? And he says, think about it. If you were a 1916 American billionaire, you could, of course, afford prime real estate. You could afford a home on Fifth Avenue or one overlooking the Pacific Ocean. But when you traveled from your Manhattan digs to your West Coast palace, it would still take you a few days. And if you made that trip during the summer months, you'd likely not have air conditioning in your private railroad car. You could neither listen to radio, the first commercial radio broadcast occurred in 1920, nor watch television. Obviously, you couldn't download music. Your telephone was attached to the wall. You couldn't use it to Skype. Even the best medical care back then was horrid by today's standards. Much more painful, much less effective. Antibiotics weren't available. Dental care wasn't any better. You were completely cut off from the cultural richness that globalization has spawned over the past century. And he says, I wouldn't be remotely tempted to quit the 2016 me so that I could be a $1 billion richer me in 1916. That fact means, by 1916 standards, I am today more than a billionaire. It means that, at least given my preferences, I am today materially richer than was John D. Rockefeller. So the bottom line is, we become richer and we can continue to become richer, but how fast things improve, that's partly a function of government policy. If we can impose some restraints on the scope and size of government, that will give the private sector some breathing room to grow and prosper. You don't need perfect policy, but you have to have good policy.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.